Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So what a fun day today has been. No military parade. I'm so sad. So sad that we're not going to have the big ego boost for the Marmalade Mussolini. Sad, sad stuff. And I'm sure I can't. I've been following the Trump Twitter feed, waiting for the temper tantrum. Nothing yet. Still waiting. He's still stuck on Brennan and stuck on the rigged witch hunt. It's not just a rich witch hunt anymore. It's a rigged witch hunt, which I don't get. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on, the big parade and episode 3 of Gaslit Nation. I've asked Sarah Kenzie, your co-host of Gaslit Nation, to come talk with us. Sarah, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So no big parade. So sad.
This is the first that I've heard of this. I just saw today that it was supposed to cost $92 million. When did it get canceled?
Right around 4:30 this afternoon, the Pentagon said they were considering postponing it. They're going to postpone it to maybe 2019.
Which makes me go,
they're just trying to push it off. Because how do you justify spending $92 million on something that only one person wants?
It's grotesque. Like, I saw that earlier, the tweet about the cost, and I was so angry. Like, I was just thinking, of the money that could go to veterans, to health care, to, PTSD care, for, all these things that people really need. And, like, what a total... Sorry, I know I'm not supposed to swear on your show. Like, jerk. that doesn't do it. What a horrible, horrible person he is to do that and to run up that kind of amount of money. And, I also kept wondering, what is really the purpose of this? Because obviously Trump doesn't care about veterans. He doesn't care about people who serve in the military. He's insulted veterans, including, the Han family, including McCain. So, I kept wondering, is there money laundering aspect to this? Is it just, I felt like there's something beyond pageantry. So at any rate, it's very good that at least they're postponing it. But they should cancel that altogether, and they should reallocate the funding, to the actual families who served.
I'm right there with you. I mean, it's one of those things that it's mind blowing. But what I did find interesting is that they waited until after he signed the NDAA to then pull this back.
Yeah, no, that is all interesting. Whenever there's anything that kind of goes away from the consolidating of autocracy that we've been witnessing for the last year, I find it interesting. And, of every division, Mattis and the Department of Defense has been, the most likely to kind of stand up to him, although really not as much as people think he does, and really not as much as they should. But I'm glad that at least this seems to have been, kicked down the road and hopefully just terminated forever.
Yeah, I'm hoping so as well. So let's get to episode number 3. Before we get into all the nuts and bolts and all the things that I liked, I got to take issue. How can you possibly not like the Beatles?
They're boring. I don't hate them or something. Like, there's worse out there, but they're just I don't know. People are going to hate me after this. They've got no soul. Like, I like George Harrison. I like the guitar. I don't feel it. You know what I mean? Like, it has to, come from, the gut. Like, I don't feel it. Sorry.
I guess
you're
just
hang up on me now.
No, I heard that. I'm going, it's just wrong.
We can take Back in the USSR. Andrea and I can use that. Although I guess you've got that one on your show, so I don't know. We have to share.
Yeah, well, that's there you go. There are some. There was some of it that it was kind of campy, and you got to remember the time. It was revolutionary for the time. They were the, and then you go and you say nice things about George Michael.
Rick, you saw my dad. I love George Michael. I was super, super sad today about Aretha Franklin, and also brought to mind George Michael because I love that video. And, I don't know. I mean, if you go through, the most damning thing about me is probably, my, iPod, so we shouldn't go down this road.
I'm just screwing with you. I just wanted to throw that out there because I'm going, how can you not like the Beatles?
They're okay. See, this just shows Andrea and I can bridge these boundaries. I'm a Stones person. She's a Beatles person. It's all good.
All good. So let's get to it. You started off by talking about Robert Mueller, who gave a speech back in 2011, kind of laid all this stuff out. And I didn't know that. I'd never heard of the speech. And in fact, I ran and I went and I looked it up, and I'm like, holy wow, you know, they knew about this, you know, years before it was happening, and most of us weren't paying attention to it.
Yeah, exactly. I thought it was interesting the lack of coverage that speech gave, but, you know, for those listening, the speech is about what Mueller called the Iron Triangle, which is basically like a new way of, you know, conceptualizing crime, you know, where you have these, you know, intersecting layers of corporate crime, of mafia-style criminals, and of people in government. And, you know, and they overlap so that the head of a Fortune 500 company is a criminal. I mean, we see this kind of thing. We saw this in 2008 with the global recession, you know, with the bankers that should have gone to jail. We've seen all of these manipulations in the stock market. We've seen the kind of tactics that people like Manafort use, people like Stone use, where they kind of vacillate between helping, you know, corrupt politicians in the U.S., helping dictators and mafiosos abroad. You know, it's a big growth industry. And I think that that's, you know, when people view this as an international crisis, you can really see these tentacles kind of stretching everywhere. And you certainly see it in things like offshore bank accounts and this globalized kleptocracy. But yeah, I think everyone should read that speech by Mueller. I think it's very interesting that he doesn't just talk about that, but specifically talks about the threat of the Russian mafia, talks about Semyon Mogilevich, who's the head of the Russian mafia, you know, a very dangerous guy. He was on the FBI's most wanted list until December 2015, when, for reasons that remain unexplained, Comey took him off. So Mueller leaves out this threat very clearly. I would assume that, you know, Mueller left in 2013, Comey replaced him, but that the FBI, of course, should have recognized that Trump and Manafort and this group of people embody the very threat that Mueller laid out. Like, it's not a stretch, you know, like you read that and you instantly realize that these are the kind of people we're talking about, which, of course, again, leads me to this question of why didn't they do anything? Why didn't they indict earlier? How did they let these people get so close to the presidency and then capture the presidency? Like, it honestly blows my mind.
And, you know, as I was listening to you talk about it, you know, it was one of these things where you think about, you know, Trump was the perfect character in this because he was kind of fluid in all of those worlds. You know, because I have friends who live in New York who say, look, you can't get anything done in New York City on that scale without dealing with the different, you know, different organized crime groups. And, you know, he was perfect. He was able to manipulate them. And I wouldn't say manipulate, but navigate those different avenues.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, his father was hooked up to those organized crime networks before. And, you know, New York real estate is notorious for that. His mentor, Roy Cohn, you know, was a mafia lawyer and also somebody who had political ties, you know, to all sorts of people in the U.S. government, but also people in New York City especially. And I think the combination of Fred Trump and Roy Cohn gave him entree into this way of making money off of very shady characters. And, you know, Trump was ideal for them. You know, he's this hollow shell in certain respects that can just be toyed with and manipulated to do what they want as long as his bank account and his ego are stroked. But he's also sadistic. He's also very good at marketing and PR. He doesn't have any shame. You know, there's no way to humiliate him on a personal level. It has to be on a legal level. Like, that's something I've been stressing since 2015, all these people that think these sort of, you know, insulting things he says or, you know, that he does that are not technically illegal will bring him down. You know, they're absolutely deluded. They have to track his illegal interactions, and they need to indict him. That is the only way that he will ever go away, and that's the only way that we'll get our country back. But yeah, he was ripe for the picking, and, you know, the length of time and the expansiveness of this operation is really unsettling, as is the fact that so few did anything about it. And it raises a lot of questions about the New York FBI, about Giuliani in particular. And it's just kind of like, why were these guys able to carry on like this for such an extended period of time? And not just carry on, but be accepted into New York high society, be accepted into, you know, the upper echelons of U.S. political life. You know, they were running campaigns for presidential candidates for decades. And this is just like the scum of the earth hooked up to an international mafia syndicate. Like, you know, it's not my damn job to fix this, but it's somebody's job, and they clearly weren't doing it.
No, and you lay it out perfectly, and I hope people will take a look at Gaslit Nation, download the podcast, and I'm hoping it goes to a weekly very soon, because I find it, you know, just extremely informative. But, you know, one of the things I've been saying for years is that, you know, we no longer have those bank robbers of the 30s that everyone, you know, Bonnie and Clyde, Babyface Nelson, you know, all, we no longer have those kind of criminals. They're all now corporate CEOs, and it's right in line with what you're saying. They, you know, you want to rob a bank today, become the CEO of it.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and there are all these schemes that are being done, and certainly not, you know, limited to interactions with Russia. You know, there's been all sorts of things going on with China. And yeah, you know, Mueller explicitly says that in his speech. He says this is not The Sopranos. This is not some guy shaking down people at a diner. You know, this is extremely complicated, and it's, you know, the border between corporate and criminals blurred. The border between legal and illegal action is also blurred when you don't have regulations, when you don't have repercussions, and when you have a government that lets these guys just run wild. And, of course, when you have the extent of dark money in politics that we have, and, you know, things like Citizens United and this ability to just pump this money into campaigns, I mean, it's just... it's a nightmare of incredible scope, and it's very frustrating to me. You know, now, of course, I say that, and then people are like, oh, well, that's why it's taking so long. You know, Mueller needs to put all the pieces together, get it all wrapped up perfectly, or else things will go wrong, which, you know, one, like, we have a completely decomposing legal system that may not be around much longer. You know, I'm kind of looking at what's going on with the Manafort trial in a very wary way, the way the judge is behaving and
that's what I was going to ask you next.
Yeah, then, you know, the other thing is, it is not, I think he should indict and get the most threatening, destructive people out now, before they hurt any more people. Because having a baby in a cage, having kids lose their parents forever, things like that, there's nothing that is worth that. There's nothing that, you know, justifies dragging this out in the way that it is. Like, it needs to go faster. I'm not saying wrap it up. I'm not saying complete it, because I think that we're going to have, you know, probably hundreds of indictments, and it's going to go on for a very long time. But just, you got to get these guys out, because no one should be suffering in that way. And people will not be able to just get their lives back once Trump is gone, if he's gone. You know, there's going to be tremendous damage. And in the case, I can't get these kids out of my head. Like, the trauma of that, and the parents, you know, that's forever. So, you know, shame on us. Like, shame on people who should have stopped it. And I don't know. Sorry. Anyway,
you're absolutely right. And, you know, at the end of this, you know, what I, you know, because I try and bring it up that, you know, look, this is still going on, because right now we're focused on another pie fight, and that's between Trump and this Omarosa or Omarosa. And you go, now that's what the media is all focused on. And, you know, is there a tape of the N-word, and is there this? And you go, hey, what about over here? What about all of this other stuff that's going on?
Oh, it blows my mind that they're still having this little debate of, is Trump a racist? It's like, yes, he's a racist. That's why we have kids from Central America, you know, put in cages and taken from their parents and treated like animals and tortured and shot up with drugs. Like, that's what a Nazi-like racist does. And he doesn't need to be recorded saying the N-word to prove that, although we've had plenty of times that he said absolutely horrific things about Black Americans. You know, he's degraded. Rated that. Like, this is just a completely consistent part of his character. You can find this all the way back to, I think it was 1973. He was sued for racial discrimination. So was Fred Trump. Like, the mystery is solved. Like, people need to move on to how everyday people, how ordinary people are being affected by this and how they're suffering, and not these debates between former White House employees that, you know, say they have tapes, and if she does, fine. But, you know, as I said before, you need to have them used in a legal capacity. I hope she goes and works with Mueller. I hope she actually tries to bring him to justice and isn't just dribbling this shit out, like, for fortune and fame and to sell books. Like, that's extremely unethical. That doesn't actually help our country. And, you know, maybe she has more faith in it standing than I do, but you know, things got to go quicker and things have to be clearer.
I'm with you. Let's talk a little bit about today's the news that come out of the Mueller, the Manafort trial. Evidently, they asked for, the jury has asked for, you know, the definition of reasonable doubt They've asked for something on how all of the evidence equates to different charges. They've asked for if somebody, I guess somebody who controls the distribution of money, but they only have partial responsibility, what that looks like. There were four questions, and all of them point to me to be going, they're looking for, somebody's pointing them in a direction to look for a way out. And immediately I'm thinking of, you know, the movie The 12 Angry Jurors. Or one of those movies where just one person is planting the seed in everyone's head. And my concern is that at the end of this, he walks on this and everything else falls apart.
Yeah, that's my concern too, because I basically thought, well, if I were this Manafort's team, like, what would I do? I would tamper with the jury. I would intimidate them. I would bribe them. I would threaten them. I would manipulate them. I would do the same thing to the judge. The jury wasn't sequestered, and Manafort, you know, was indicted for witness tampering like 3 months ago or something, very recently. He does not care that he's been indicted. He doesn't care that he's embroiled in this. He's doing absolutely everything he can to weasel his way out. I think a pardon is kind of the last resort for them. I think they're looking for an acquittal, and I don't know whether they've found a way to do it. You know, I'm discouraged by those questions from the jury. I'm very discouraged that they weren't sequestered. I mean, you could like manipulate these guys through social media, probably. I don't know what regulations they have. I think some things that are going on are, you know, standard legal procedure. We're just not used to analyzing these cases so closely. But on the other hand, you know, you need to look at these cases and what may seem standard in the particular context, which involves a, you know, mobbed up former campaign manager to the current president of the United States who is serving the interests of a foreign power and has no respect for the law. Like, we haven't had that particular situation before, so I don't think that we should expect things to move normally, and I don't think we should necessarily expect justice to be served. But yeah, it will be just devastating if he's acquitted. I mean, I think that, you know, there are more charges coming, so it's not like, I'm not quite sure everything would end with this, but it would certainly be disheartening, and it would show that, you know, Trump has gotten hold of the judiciary in a significant way. We know he's been stacking courts with judges. We know he's been firing everybody who's been investigating him, whether people in the FBI or, you know, people like Preet Bharara or Sally Yates all the way back last year. And so this is just the next step of consolidation, and it would just be grotesque if he walks free. You know, this is a guy with blood on his hands. This is just if you listen to our podcast, if you listen to Gaslit Nation, you get a very detailed description of his activities in the U.S., in the Ukraine, and to, you know, my co-host Andrea Chalupa's sister. Like, this is personal for us. So, yeah, I hope there's a guilty verdict, but I kind of lean towards thinking there won't be.
Yeah, and that's the scary part. And then today, I also saw the story that evidently George Papadopoulos' wife is saying that, you know, she wants him to back out of the plea deal, scrap that, because they claim they have exculpatory evidence that would fully justify them being able to do that. And, you know, you start looking at all of these pieces, is this the assault to make everything fall apart before Mueller has a chance to lay everything else out?
That's what I'm wondering, too. And I'm wondering whether Manafort has a heads up on what the outcome of this is going to be. You know, there's been all these reports of him, you know, winking at his wife in the courtroom, and, you know, they're certainly acting confident and smug. And that's true of the GOP in general. No one really seems that concerned about the Mueller probe. I think they just kind of enjoy demonizing it, of course, because they don't want Americans to take it seriously. But yeah, the fact that Papadopoulos and his wife are making this particular move now, as the Manafort case is going on and may be wrapped up soon, I think is troubling, because I think they're seeing a potential opening. They're like, well, why should we, you know, plea? Why should we help if we can just get off scot-free and probably go on, you know, ripping people off and making more money by working, with the terrible people in the Trump administration? I think they're making a pragmatic call. And if that's what they think is happening, I mean, that's a very bad sign, and that's why I've been saying all along, you can't rely on the system to work, and you can't go by the book when the book is burning. You really need to pick up the pace and get these guys indicted and unable to influence the judicial process as much as you can. I mean, the fact that Manafort was able to, you know, kind of play with some witness tampering when he was supposed to be, you know, locked up and away from society, the fact that he had a computer and email, I'm still wondering about that. I mean, that's insane. Of course, he shouldn't have been allowed that stuff. So I don't really understand how they're running things or why they're running things the way they are.
For me, it just looks like more political theater. Last question I've got for you. I don't know if you saw Trump's tweet today. That the fake news media is the opposition party. It's very bad for our great country, but we are winning, he said. Doesn't every president believe that the media is the opposition? And isn't that what we really want?
Yeah, in a sense. I mean, this isn't new. It's weird to me that people in the media are kind of reacting like this is the first time Trump said this, because both Trump and Bannon said this straight out the gate, like right after he was inaugurated. Like, I know this because I went on MSNBC and, you know, was asked, like, is the media the opposition party? And I was like, you know, they think I am. Well, I oppose them. Fine. Like, you know, call me what you want. Like, I'm going to say what the hell I'm thinking, and I'm going to, you know, investigate this whether you like it or not. But yeah, you know, the media should not have a close and cozy relationship with the executive branch or any other branch of government. They should be there as a check on power. You know, they should be there to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. Like, that's the old adage. And the fact that this is apparently a mind-blowing concept for most of the media startles me a bit. But, you know, I definitely hope that, if anything, you know, Trump's very blatant attacks finally prompt networks to stop putting all of his lackeys on TV, particularly those who are under federal investigation, like Giuliani, and, well, I don't know if Giuliani is per se, but, you know, certainly Michael Caputo, Roger Stone, you know, Steve Bannon is just such a giant slime ball. I suspect he's under investigation as well. But, like, why are you promoting these people? Why are you giving these people, like, 1 hour, you know, specials to spread their hate? You know, how is that good for journalism? How is that good for anybody? Like, I don't get it. So you'd hope they'd at least learn some kind of lesson here, especially when journalists, of course, have been attacked. You know, we had journalists killed in Maryland very recently, and just out of respect to that, you'd think they'd cut this out. But I don't know. It's like everyone learns a lesson, and they absorb it for, like, 24 hours, and then selective amnesia comes in, and they just forget everything decent and good they learned and go back to square one, and we just relive 2016 over and over again until, I don't know, climate change sucks us all into a vortex or something. I don't know how this ends, but I don't think it's going to end well.
Wow, there's a positive outlook.
I was going to say, on that note,
I want to live in your brain.
You should have stuck with the Beatles, man. This went down a bad road.
But that's why we need to listen to your podcast, which I think is fantastic, Gaslit Nation. Make sure you take a look at it, and every episode. When's the next one coming out?
It is coming out on Monday, and we're talking about election security, election integrity, what we can do in the midterm. So please give a listen to that one. We're kind of finishing up the production now. Andrea and I have also set up a Patreon, I don't know how to pronounce it, where people can donate if they'd like to see us go weekly. We're currently on a bi-weekly schedule, but getting there, and, you know, every bit helps, even if it's just like a dollar a month or something. That goes a long way for us, so we would appreciate that, and, you know, we're really glad everyone is excited about it and listening. It's been cool to see the response.
No, it is good stuff. Sarah, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much. Keep it up, and look forward to having you back to talk about episode number 4.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for having me.
Terrific. Thanks so much, our good friend Sarah Kendzior. Again, Gaslit Nation, check it out. Dame Magazine, all of that. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.